From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with veterinarian Deborah Horwitz, DVM, DACVB, a diplomate and past president of the ACVB, who serves on several advisory boards for corporations and publications related to animal behavior, health, and welfare. She's a co-editor of the new book, Decoding Your Cat. The ultimate experts explain common cat behaviors and reveal how to prevent or change unwanted ones. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. In the United States, one of the predominant reasons that owners abandon or give up their pets, often leading to euthanasia, is unwanted behaviors. Rather than instruct proper cat training, this book provides an in-depth understanding of the underlying reasons for a cat's problem behavior, the essential key to unlocking the best for you and your cat and avoiding pitfalls. Decoding Your Cat gives owners new insight on promoting their cat's physical and psychological health and wellness and maintaining a long and fulfilling relationship together. The book is written by leading experts in cat behavior from the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists, with an introduction by animal expert Steve Dale. Together with anecdotes from real-life situations and the science behind how cats relate to their world, Decoding Your Cat seeks to empower owners to provide a home environment that is happy, safe, and functional, to identify and seek treatment for medical health problems, to understand how to deal with unwanted behaviors, and in general to help cats live longer and fuller lives. I spoke with Dr. Deborah Horwitz last week by phone. I started by asking her why it sometimes seems that people are either all cat people or dog people. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
For many reasons. Number one, dogs and cats are different. They can be similar in many ways, but they're different in the way they approach relationships with people. Let's put it that way.
Yep.
Dogs are ethologically predisposed to look for social contacts, because they are group living animals. So there's a difference in the way that generally dogs approach people or other dogs that they meet. And while cats can live in groups and often do live in groups, those are based on clumped resources, because cats are predatory animals and they hunt very small prey. So when they're by themselves out in the wild, it doesn't work to have another cat hunting with you, because a field mouse really isn't very much energy if you split it with another cat. But if there are food resources, like in a dairy barn or someplace in a park or even in a home where people provision the cats, they can live in groups, whereas dogs generally choose to live in groups because of the way they feed. Their ancestors hunted large hoof stock, and they are foragers, so they eat garbage and all kinds of other things. So they tend to congregate in groups, but dogs are a little bit different than wolves in that they don't form packs. So I think that's the first thing.
Yeah.
But I also tell people that people who say, I don't like cats, my general answer, without trying to be flippant about it, is you haven't met the right cat. Because cats, like dogs, have very different personalities if you get to know them. Some cats are very outgoing and follow you around the house like they're a dog. And some cats would prefer a little more alone time because they're acting like they're natural predators. But it depends what you want in your animal. So right. It's just like people get lap dogs, small little dogs that will sit on your lap all the time, and somebody else wants a dog that goes jogging with them. It's just what you want in your pet.
Right. Okay. That's a great answer. But I think it comes up so often, like people will say, oh, I'm a cat person, I'm not a dog person, or the other way around. And very seldom do I hear people say that they're equal on it.
I am.
You're equal on it.
Yeah.
Was that always the case?
Yes. I'm a veterinarian, so I really love animals. But sometimes dogs depend on where you are in your life or
right.
where you can live. It's a little harder sometimes to have a dog in certain living circumstances, although that's changed. Dogs have different needs for elimination, which really is sometimes a dividing line for some people. Some people say, well, I don't have a yard, mm-hmm. and I don't want to take my dog out for a walk. And other people say, I hate litter boxes, I don't want to have to change them. So bringing animals into our house requires more than just their personality, but also how they are managed, how sure. we take care of them. And some people find certain types of care more acceptable to them than others.
Yeah. My husband and I have both a cat and a dog, and the two of them play together all the time. And it was interesting as I was reading the book to kind of look to see, you know, am I recognizing my cat's behavior accurately? Is he really enjoying this as much as I think he is, or is he maybe not as happy as I was hoping? And it was interesting to me to read that the tail wagging, which does look different on a cat, it's much more kind of switchy. Is not necessarily, right. It's not a happy sign. So that will help me in the future to kind of, anticipate, is he having fun or is he not having fun right now?
Well, also though, sometimes, for example, I have two cats right now. I've had cats and dogs together. I've had one cat. I have two cats right now. And sometimes when they're playing with each other, they look a little antagonistic. They'll flip their tails around, they'll put their tails back, but it's play fighting. So sometimes your cat might say, here I am, the fierce little cat, I'm going to get you. And the next thing you know, he's hopping sideways. And so they have different play postures.
Right. It's like a little kid with a fake sword.
Yes, it very much is. That's a great description. And so if a cat really didn't want to play, they'd get up someplace high and the dog couldn't get him.
Right. Yeah. No, I know that Mango, my cat, likes to play because he'll pick fights with the dog and kind of tease him and run away and try to get it started. So, yeah.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about cats and the kind of reputation that in your book I discovered is perhaps unwarranted. The reputation for being a little bit vindictive or angry when they don't like a person's behavior. So, for example, if somebody moves their litter box, they might pee other places. But sometimes they'll pee other places and you assume they're mad at you and maybe something else is going on. And I'm just wondering if we can talk about that a little bit.
I think that hopefully I won't offend some of your listeners, but I think it's disingenuous to think that our animals are out to get us when they do some unwanted behavior.
Okay.
Usually they have a reason. They pick that behavior for a reason. And being spiteful, if you really look at spiteful behavior within the definition used by animal ethologists, people who study how animals act in their natural environment, spiteful behavior is a behavior that doesn't really help the sender, the person who's doing it, or the receiver, the person who gets it.
Uh-huh.
And animals generally don't deal in spiteful behavior because if they do, it has no benefit for them. It doesn't get them more food. It doesn't get them more mates. It doesn't get them necessarily more peace and quiet. Usually when they're reacting to something, it's because they're anxious or they're upset. Now, it may seem spiteful to us because we don't understand the reason that they've decided to choose that behavior. But spite or anger is really not the genesis of that. For example, when you move the litter box to someplace different, cats can be very attached to their territory,
sure.
to what they consider their core area. Or maybe the place where you have the litter box is where they consider they are safe when they go to the bathroom. We like bathrooms with doors. We close them. And sometimes we put litter boxes in places where the cat feels really vulnerable while it's trying to eliminate. And then we take that away from them because that's inconvenient. A good example would be sometimes people have an unused bathroom in their house and they put the litter box there. And then their family grows and they need that bathroom. And suddenly it's someplace else. And the cat goes, well, wait a minute, this was nice and quiet. Nobody ever came in here. I like it here. Why do I have to go to the bathroom somewhere else? So my favorite saying that I tell clients is change is only pleasurable when it's your idea. Nobody likes change unless it's their idea, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So when we change something that's our idea and we haven't prepared our pet for it, they're like confused. And angry is not the right word, really. It would be, it's sort of like when you go to sit down in your desk and somebody pulls a chair out from behind you. Now, that is kind of spiteful, but what if you yourself moved it so you could climb on it to get something else and you forgot to put it back?
Right.
Right?
Right.
You'd be like, who changed that? Oh, I changed that. I'm mad at me.
That's funny. Now, we used to have a cat named Kava who was gray, and she was very unpredictable. She liked some members of the family more than others, or she was maybe a little more comfortable with some members of the family over others, but she could be kind of erratic in her biting and occasional scratching, sort of just like last minute. So I have two questions. One is that kind of behavior, but the other is that at the time, the vet we were seeing said that they had a little joke at the office that she has gray cat disease because gray cats seem to have that behavior more than others. Is that, does that ring true for you?
No, it doesn't. I've had cats of all colors and several different purebred cats, but again, cats have much subtler signs of displeasure, especially for physical contact. Another saying that I use all the time, that proximity doesn't mean a willingness to interact. Mm-hmm. So just because your cat's sitting next to you on the couch doesn't mean they want to be petted.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And same with a dog in their dog bed or even a dog on the couch. They vary. Some dogs are like, oh, that's great. Pet me some more. And some will get up and move over.
Right.
And so cats are a little bit different in the way they respond to intrusions, depending on who it's from. If a cat can run away and they're not cornered, often they will run away. But if they're cornered somehow, they don't perceive they can get away fast enough, they may do something that is a more aggressive response. And there's a good explanation for that, actually. When we look at cats in general are the most evolved predators on the planet. The lion is a wonderful predator. And our domestic cats have evolved from small desert cats that are wonderful predators, but they're tiny. And so besides being predators, they're also prey. And if you think of prey animals, what's the first thing that they do when they're in danger? First, they freeze and hide if they can.
Right.
The second thing is they run away.
Right.
So if a cat's quickly confronted with what they consider to be dangerous, it doesn't matter whether the intent is danger, they might freeze. And if the person continues to do something and they can't run away because they're too close, they don't know that you can't catch them sometimes, you know what I'm saying?
Right,
then they
right.
will lash out.
Yeah, okay.
They'll lash out.
Yeah. Let's see. I wanted to... Oh, okay. So another behavioral thing while we're on it, this is another thing that Mango does. He will roll over as we approach, and we've always assumed he wanted a belly rub because he would roll over and give us his belly, and he doesn't seem to mind it very much. But it's true that he doesn't seem to like it very, or he doesn't care, right? So in reading the book, I was realizing, oh my gosh, he isn't telling me to rub his belly. He's just saying hi.
Correct.
Is that
Correct.
True?
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's, you know, when a cat rolls over on their side or shows their belly, it means they're very relaxed with you. Because think about it again from the standpoint of predator and prey.
Right.
When you roll over and show your belly, you're vulnerable. And that means, oh, I'm not afraid of you. Now, some cats do like a little bit of a scritch on their belly. I find that what my cats really want is they'll tip their head back and maybe a little rub on their chest and under their chin is what they prefer, you know. But sometimes when you go and put your arm down, I bet that your cat sometimes puts all four legs around and holds on.
Right. Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Not all the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I think he's putting up with me more than I knew.
well, because he trusts you. He's not afraid of you. And he likes you. And he says, well, to the human, this is important. I'll humor them.
That's great. I wanted to ask you about one aspect of the book from a sort of like administrative standpoint. The book is somehow under the umbrella of the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists. So I don't know anything about that group, and I assume that it's an important professional association. Can you just talk about that and how the book came to be?
Sure, I'd love to talk about that. Veterinary medicine has specialty colleges, just like human medicine. So we have internists and oncologists and surgeons and nutritionists and orthopedists, dermatologists, I could go on and on. And one of the specialties is behavioral medicine.
Right.
And specialty colleges in human medicine have specialty training and examinations, and they do in veterinary medicine. So the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists is a specialty college under the umbrella of the American Veterinary Medical Association that certifies veterinarians who specialize in the treatment of behavior problems in dogs, cats, horses, whatever. There's also a College of Zoological Medicine as well, zoo animals. Uh-huh. And in order to be a specialist, you have to, besides being a veterinarian, so veterinary school is 4 years post-undergraduate. So all veterinary behaviorists have graduated from a three-year or four-year veterinary college. Uh-huh. They've done a year or more of general practice, and then they have done training in a residency program where they learn how to treat behavior cases beyond what a regular veterinarian would get in their veterinary school, which means classes on pharmacology and physiology of behavior, neurology, pharmacology, ethology, learning about the normal behaviors of animals. Then in order to become certified, they have to submit 3 case reports that get reviewed, and they sit for a two-day exam, which we just administered and welcomed 4 new veterinary behaviorists into our college. Yeah. And we've been established since we gave our first exam in 1995, and I passed in 1996, and we are now up to nearly 100 veterinary behaviorists. So
wow.
That's what we are. And our first book, we wrote a book before this,
yes,
called Decoding Your Dog. And that came about from a lot of requests for a book and a lot of thought amongst ourselves. Was this part of our mission to help educate the public? And we decided yes. And HMH supported us in that. And it was very, very well received. And when we came back, and I was the lead editor on that one. And when we came back a couple years later and asked them if they'd like to do Decoding Your Cat, they sort of jumped at that because Decoding Your Dog was very well received. And so Decoding Your Cat was requested all the time by everyone. And we said, okay, we'll do that.
Yeah.
And here it is.
Yeah. And it's such a popular subject. I mean, the people I've been talking to who, you know, who heard that I was going to be talking to you were like, oh my gosh, I need to look at that book. It sounds great. And I need to understand my cat better. So.
And we hope that this does that for people. We think that it does.
Yeah.
It's the same format as Decoding Your Dog in that we start with a little vignette.
Right.
To show the cat behavior. Then we talk about myths and facts versus fiction and why this behavior has come about. Then we talk about how to change it. And then at the end, we say, what did we say? So that every chapter follows the same format. They're written by different veterinary behaviorists. The editors are Dr. Megan Heron, myself, and Dr. Carla Siracusa. And what we try to do is take the people through with facts, with science, so that they really understand their cat and do away with all the myths and the mystery. And I don't think the mystery helps cats or dogs in the long run. I think the truth of who they really are, to me, makes them more desirable. I would never want my dog to be a cat or my cat to be a dog.
Right. Well, I think, too, the myth part of it was interesting because we all become very attached to our myths. But, you know, if you can let go and think about it, it really does help to know that your cat is not being mean, for example, or that your cat is not, you know, dissing you when it has certain behaviors.
Right. I mean, I think sometimes our cats go, you did what? But
well, they have personalities for sure. Yeah.
And that's from a cat's point of view. I mean, we look at our cats and go, you clean yourself with your tongue? You know, I mean, you know, we have the same sort of reaction.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about bringing home a new cat. And I'm sure it's maybe, well, I don't know. I think it's probably different if you're bringing home a kitten versus an adult cat that's already had some life experience, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Maybe a few tips for bringing home a new cat.
A new kitten or a new cat?
Right. So either way, I'm sure they're a
either
little
way.
Bit different. Yeah.
They are different. Okay. Because kittens are most open to being socialized to humans. In other words, getting to know what they're all about.
Right.
And more likely to approach people eagerly if they have no experience between 2 and 9 weeks. So it's nice to get kittens earlier rather than later. That doesn't mean that if they've been handled or they've lived in a house with a lot of people, that's okay. But kittens in general are pretty curious about a lot of stuff, and they are happy to get to know you. They are tiny, so we have to make sure that they don't get into places where we can't retrieve them. Because remember, a kitten is like a cat. It wants to hide if it's afraid.
Right,
so they'll
yeah.
get into tiny nooks and crannies.
Right.
So you want to, both for a kitten and an adult cat, have a room set aside that is their safe place and has everything that they need in it. It has a litter box. It has a food and water bowl, probably separated. It has a hiding place, whether that's your carrier that you leave out all the time, and we can come back to why that's a great idea. It has someplace high that they can get up on. It has a way for you to control egress and exit, and it also has lights you can turn on and off. That way, we can say to the kitten, here you are, you're safe. You have everything you need. I'm going to come in and visit you. I'm just going to sit on the floor, get to know you, and when you feel more comfortable with me, I'm going to carry you to someplace else, leave you out here for a little while, and bring you back. Same for an adult cat. Kittens get into lots of trouble once they can climb. They climb all over everything. So they can be dangerous, right?
Sure.
Because they'll try and climb up on something that's unstable. But sometimes you have to kitten-proof your house.
Right.
An adult cat may not have had early experience with people, so that's something you might want to know. If it did have early experience with people, maybe it was only adults, never had experience with kids, didn't have experience with dogs, maybe didn't have experience with other cats. So again, this place that's safe, cats want to be safe, they need to be safe, they're very attached to territory, so if we give them their own space in the very beginning where they can mark with their cheeks, and use
right.
the litter box and mark in that, and find a place to hide, then they know that they're safe. And
yeah.
adult cats sometimes offer a bit more of a challenge, and we can talk about that if you like at a
sure.
different time or now.
Sure, now's great.
All right, some people get adult cats who hide a lot when they bring them into the house.
Right.
And as I told you, hiding is a normal cat behavior when they're scared. They're
okay.
tiny. We could hurt them. All right. Doesn't mean they hate us. It means I don't know what's happening here.
Right.
Don't pull them out from under the bed. Make sure that it's quiet in there, that they have food, water, a litter box. And then normally what I tell people to do is just sit down quietly in the room. Check your email. Just sit on the floor if necessary. If you can't sit on the floor, sit in a chair. If the cat has just gotten to your house and isn't really afraid, it probably will come out slowly, sniff your feet, sniff the room, resist that desire to pick them up and scrunch them to you. Let them, you can tell by their body posture, if they're walking slowly with their tail down and head going side to side, they're looking for danger. Don't make yourself dangerous. Just watch and maybe talk to them in a low voice. Hi, kitty. I keep my cats in my kitchen and laundry room overnight because they're still sort of kittens. When I come in the morning, I always say, how are my girls? And this morning I went in and said, how are my beauties this morning? And they meow back to me. And if you talk to your cat, sometimes they'll talk back to you. And the meow tells you how they're feeling. You know, short little chirps say, oh, we're fine, I'm happy. Long, low sounds may, I'm not too happy, I'm kind of scared. And silence also means that they're scared.
Yeah.
If the cat comes to you right away, then reach down and maybe touch the top of the head. And if the cat lifts up to reach your fingers and then slides its face and its whole body along your hand, then you got it made. This cat likes you.
Yeah.
But don't rush into things. Give it time. And then after a period of time, if you see it jump on the bed, for example, and go to sleep, there you go. Aha. We're halfway there. Then you might want to leave and go out and come back. For the cat that won't come out from under the bed, I often recommend that you come prepared with really delicious, delectable treats, maybe even little pieces of chicken in a bowl,
uh-huh.
and just sit there and read your email or read a book or even read out loud to the cat so they get a sense of your voice. And if they don't come out, great. Do it for 5 or 10 minutes and leave and come back often. And the cat will learn that, okay, you're safe. Don't rush it. Don't
right.
rush it. Dogs will bite you if you rush it. Cats will stay hidden if they don't feel safe.
Okay. All right. Great. Now, as far as bringing an adult cat into your home, or really even a kitten, but I'm thinking more about an adult cat, if that cat has been in a shelter, are you more likely to see some problems, or is that not necessarily so?
It's not necessarily so. It depends the reason that it was given up to the shelter. Kittens are often found in a shelter because people had, their cat had kittens. Their cat got outside and was impregnated and had kittens, and they don't have homes for them, so they take them to the shelter.
Right.
Sometimes kittens are rescued from feral cats who've had these kittens, and people try to have contact with them. Like the mother might not let them touch her, but she'll let them interact with the kittens and feed them. And then when they're older, bring them in to be adopted, already used to people. Adult cats are given away for a variety of reasons. They're often, the most common reasons that cats are relinquished to shelters is house soiling and aggression towards another cat in the house.
Okay.
Those are the two most common reasons. And house soiling has a lot of different reasons, as the book goes into, for being relinquished. And sometimes it's a bad match.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bad match for that house.
And we'll let the book have some of its secrets so that people want
to
actually go look
at it.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask about cat fights. So every once in a while, you'll hear cats outside getting into some sort of interaction that just sounds absolutely horrific. Is something terrible happening, or do they just make those noises when they encounter one another? I mean, are they getting into terrible fights all the time, or is that maybe not about the violence so much as the warning?
Well, it's, I mean, cats do fight and injure one another. They bite, they can bite very hard and have deep wounds that become abscesses. But part of aggressive behavior in dogs and cats and even people is aggressive signaling. So you are really saying to your adversary, look at me. Cats puff up and they get bigger.
Right.
And then they make that horrible noise and show all their teeth. And they're basically saying to the other cat, look how big I am, how strong I am, and how loud I can be. Do you want to mess with me?
Right.
So that's honestly, and you know, we see it in humans. You know, you stand up straight, you stare someone in the eyes, you get a stern look on your face, and you let them know, I mean business. And that's what cats and dogs do. So sometimes hoping that maybe what will happen is that the one who's considered the foe says, no, I don't feel like fighting you today, and slinks away.
Right.
Other times they're fighting about territory. So often what you're hearing are tomcats, intact male cats, who are fighting over females in heaps because they want to be the father. They want to be the one to put their genes in the next generation, so to speak. But even in dogs, you see dogs that will even fight, and you hear a lot of really horrible noises. And sometimes when you pull the dogs apart, nobody's hurt because they're just trying to say, I'm stronger than you. No, I'm stronger than you. Get out of my face. They're arguing. They're arguing. And hopefully, yes?
Oh, no, go ahead. Sorry. Hopefully.
Hopefully somebody backs down and nobody's hurt, but that isn't always the case.
And you bring up a good point. Should you get involved and try to pull apart two cats or two dogs?
No, not really. I'll give you an example. For a long time, I had a German Shorthaired Pointer. It's kind of a big dog. Uh-huh. And two cats, and they lived together. And while I don't let my cats out anymore because of where I live, my other cats were indoor-outdoor cats. And every once in a while, they'd be out there. And I tried to call them in at night, and they didn't always come. They'd be out there, and I'd hear the noise you're talking about. And I'd tell my dog, his name was Merlin, I'd say, Merlin, go get your cat. And I'd let him out. And he would run to where they are. And they weren't afraid of him, but the other cats were. And he always came back with his cats, you know? I mean, he wasn't going to chase his cats. You know, he wasn't going to chase his cats. Because he knew his cats and they knew him, so they didn't run from him. But, you know, he would break up a fight and they never got injured. And after a few episodes like that, those two cats learned that when it got dark, you should come inside because there's danger out here. And so they would come and they were called and they would come in the house. And I wouldn't let them out then ever at dusk because they weren't trustworthy not to wander off.
Yeah, that's great advice. Yeah, go ahead.
If you don't have a dog, I guess it wouldn't work. But if you ran out there as a human, if you didn't get too close, you ran out there with a flashlight and stayed 10 or 20 feet away and started yelling and waving your arms, they would run off.
Okay.
Dog fights are different. Dog fights are different because if you have to get close to the dogs to pull them apart, and they may turn around and bite you. So it's really not a recommended thing to do.
Right. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more again about writing the book. You were one of a few co-editors on the book.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about soliciting the material that went into these chapters and how you managed the editing process. Who did what?
Okay. I'm going to go back a little bit to the first book, which I was the lead editor on. And the first thing we did, it was myself and John Sirabassi, is we wrote a template for the chapters. So we decided how each chapter was going to flow, what parts had to be put in it. And we started there. And we worked with an agent who helped us figure that out. We also worked with Steve Dale, who is an animal advocate and has a radio show, has been very supportive of the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists. And figured out what we wanted to say in every chapter and what we were going to cover.
Uh-huh.
Then we asked our members of the college to who wanted to write and what chapters they were interested in.
Okay.
And then not everybody wanted to write. You know, it takes time to do that. Not everybody had the time. Not everyone was interested because this is different than a lot of the writing we do scientifically. I've written several books for veterinarians. But those are different than these books because these books are for the general public. And then we paired people up and they wrote the chapters. And it was basically the same for this book, except that we had one caveat. If you'd written for the previous book, you couldn't put your name in to write for this one. We wanted to give everybody a chance. And people had favorite chapters they wanted to write, actually. Sometimes we had to ask people, would you write this one instead? Whatever. And then since they had a template, they knew what they were supposed to cover. Each of us took a certain number of chapters as the first editor. We basically kind of went in order.
Oh, okay.
And we would be the first reader of that chapter, and we would edit it.
Right.
And then we would send it on to the editor. We had a routine. So if you were in the first, I got to look at the I don't remember the numbers of chapters. Isn't that terrible? If you were in the first five or six reading them, you would send them to the person who was doing 7 through 10, who would then send theirs to the person doing 11, 12, and 13 or something like that. And we would go in a circle till everyone has read it at least once. And then we also had someone who we called the, she wasn't a content editor. That was our job. She was a, the best way to
a copy editor. Talk.
She was a copy editor. She worked for us. She was a copy editor, and she cleaned it all up.
Right.
And took away things that were repetitive. Helped make sure that everyone was in the right order. And then it came back to us, and the same thing happened again.
Gotcha.
And then they were when we had all of them, they were sent back to the publisher. And having written numerous books, my feeling is I don't go into a book ever. That is going to have multi authors without a template.
Uh-huh.
So that every chapter gives the reader the same order of the material that might have a different voice because people write different ways. And we tried to keep each writer's voice as best as we could. And let as long as they were factual and they followed the template. So when you open up the book, my other books, the first thing you're going to hear is why is this important? Or, next thing is how do you what's its prevalence? How is it diagnosed? What are the tests you need to do? All in order.
Right.
So that if somebody just wanted to pick up Decoding Your Cat and turn to the contents and say, what I really want to know about is I have an old cat. And so they go to the chapter Growing Old with Grace and Old Cats Should Learn New Tricks. And they can go and it has the same template as any of the others.
Right.
They're not going to be able they're not going to have to go, well, how will I know what I should do? Or how will I know what's true? It's all right there. And I think that's one of the enticing things about this book.
Now, you said you worked with an agent, I assume, for both of these books. Did you write a proposal in order to get your publishing contract? Okay. So you didn't actually write the book until you had a publisher.
No. We wrote the proposal and the chapter outline first. That's true. We had an agent. It's very difficult to get a book published without an agent. And our agent was most helpful for us because both in, especially in the first book, he sent us a list of other books and said, why are you better than this one?
Right.
And this one and this one. And we knew that Decoding Your Cat, we each of the editors took a bunch of the books that were competitors within our category and looked at them and read them. And this is why we're different. So yes, that's very important whenever you write a book. In the other books I've written, the same thing happens. Sometimes a publisher would approach me and say, you know, we'd like a new behavior book. What do you think? And I'd say, yeah, let me think about it. And then they said, well, bring us a proposal. So I bring in a proposal, and they would, they have an editorial staff there that looks at it, and then they would shop it around to veterinarians, basically. What do you think? Does this make sense to you? What else do you want in it? And stuff like that. So part of writing the book is knowing what you want to say and who your target audience is. That's that's an important part of writing a book.
Okay, wonderful. Let's see. Deborah, I wonder if you can tell me, actually, I should be saying Dr. Horowitz. I mean...
Either way.
Okay.
I answered to Debbie most easily, but...
Okay, Debbie. Can you just tell me, are there any books that you've read lately, one or two titles that you might recommend to listeners? Most of the listeners are of course, readers.
I'm just finishing a book now that's called Mama Day.
Okay.
And it's a very interesting book. It's a little bit... a little bit about the occult, a little bit about the supernatural, a little bit, I won't really say fantasy, but it's another way of looking at the world, and I'm not quite finished with it, so I'm eager to get it done because I want to see what happens. That's very good. The book I read just before that I really like is hopefully not too political for your audience, but it's called Self-Portrait in Black and White. And it's written by Thomas Chattington Williams. And he is a person of color who spent most of his adult life or his working life. He also has written for Harper's Bazaar and the New York Times. And he is talking about it's Self-Portrait in Black and White, Family, Fatherhood, and Rethinking Race. Mm. And I found it very, very interesting because he's writing from his personal point of view, and he starts the book. He is married to a woman who is not a person of color, and he starts the book about the birth of his first child and how that made him think about these things. And it's really, to me, a very skillfully written book in a time when we're all grappling with there are a lot of changes in our country, whether they're good or they're bad. I'm not going to comment on that, but there's change, and nobody likes change unless it's their idea, remember?
Right.
And so
right. Yeah.
This is just a good book that looks at change kind of from both points of view, since he kind of lives in both worlds. So I really enjoyed that.
Okay, and great. And that's not at all too political to bring up. You're allowed to recommend whatever you've enjoyed lately.
So. I mean, I really enjoyed the book. I really enjoyed the book without feeling... that it was so political that I'm going, oh, it was a good book. It's actually what I picked for my book club coming up.
Wonderful. It sounds like a great one to be reading right now and anytime, probably. Let's see. I wanted to also ask, are you working on any other projects, editing or writing projects in the near future?
Some chapters for different books. I'm considering a project for a journal that puts out issues on certain topics, and this one is going to be on feline behavior and welfare, and so I'm trying to decide if I'm going to write a chapter for that. So those are the projects. that I've been working on recently, written some articles recently, taking a rest from books. I will say this, since it's sort of about what it takes to write a book.
Yes.
If you're interested in that.
Absolutely.
If you are the sole editor, which I was on some of the other books I've written, and I had many authors to review and whatever, a book is a huge project that takes longer than you think.
Right.
And it takes up at least minimum from the time you get a publisher who's going to take you to publication, probably 2 years of your life. And it's there every day because you want to get it done. You have something you want to say. There's something you want to say, depending on the kind of book you write. And you can see that I'm not talking about writing a fiction book, which of course can still take a large amount of time, but I'm talking about books where you want to give information to people that's correct. And it takes a lot of time. It's always there. It's always there kind of going, you need to work on me. You need to work on me. So I'm taking a rest from the need to work on me.
Sure.
For now, because for me, I love doing it, but it really, it consumes you in a good way. A project that you really want to do should consume you. It shouldn't eat you up.
Right.
But it will consume you.
And that's actually really related to my next question. And so perhaps that's the answer to my next question, but perhaps you can also expand on it. My last question is always a question about advice. And in your case, I was going to ask, what advice do you have for listeners who are writers who are thinking about putting together a nonfiction collection on a professional topic of their own profession, which may or may not have anything to do with medicine or animals, but just, that sort of book?
I would do what we were advised to do. The first thing is I would look at what else is out there in your field of interest, and how would your book be different? How is your take different than what you've read before? What have you read before that you said, it's just not satisfying. There's something more I can give to it. And then figure out how you're going to tell that, whether it's with a chapter template. If it's going to be a book that people are going to learn from, I think that a chapter template helps. It doesn't have to be perfectly strict, but to give you focus on what you're going to write, you need to write an outline of what are the most important things I want to address in the book. We have 13 chapters in Decoding Your Cat. I think we had 14 or 15 in Decoding Your Dog. But what are the areas that you think of your professional expertise that you want to address? If there's only one, is there enough in there to write a book, or should you just write a long paper for a journal in your field, which I've done that as well.
Right.
Do you want to be the editor, or do you want to be the author, or do you want to be both? Mm-hmm. You want some colleagues to write for you. It is a different process when you write everything. The first book that I, well, not the first, but the first two books I had co-editors, and there were three of us in the first book. We each wrote a few chapters and had others write other chapters. And the next book that I did, I co-authored with a colleague of mine, and we wrote all the chapters. And it was, I don't have it in front of me, which is a little bit of an oversight, but we had lots of chapters, and it was a lot of work. We divided them in half. We came up with our topics. We came up with a template. We divided them in half, and then we each wrote our chapter, gave it to the other person who edited it, and gave it back. And so that was a different kind of work than not writing a chapter at all.
Yep.
And editing.
Right, which in the case of this book, you did not submit a chapter. Correct.
No.
Right.
Yeah. No. So it's a different kind of work, and decide where do your strengths lie. And if your strength is in writing the material, that's great. Go ahead and write it. But remember that you eventually are going to be copy edited either. And we were copy edited again by a copy editor from the publisher. But from that standpoint, the copy editing, because we had someone who got it grammatically correct, that was really questions of, I don't understand what this means.
Right.
Can somebody make it clear for me?
Yes. That's all great advice. So I'm going to mention again the name of the book, which actually takes a minute, is Decoding Your Cat, The Ultimate Experts Explain Common Cat Behaviors and Reveal How to Prevent or Change Unwanted Ones. It's from the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists, and the editors are Megan E. Herron, Carlo Siracusa, and my guest, Deborah F. Horowitz. All veterinarians and all associated with this professional organization. The book is published by HMH, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Deborah, it's been a lovely conversation, and I really am enjoying this book. I'm going to continue referring to it for a long time, I know.
Wonderful. I'm glad you enjoyed it, and it's been so nice to talk to you. You had wonderful questions, not only about cats, but in the writing process that I hadn't really thought about, so it was nice to articulate those thoughts. Thank you very much, Shayla.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was my interview with Dr. Deborah Horowitz, DVM, DACVB. You can learn more about the work of the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists at the website dacvb.org. This week's Write the Book prompt is a piece of advice that my guest, Dr. Deborah Horowitz, generously suggested. People do their best thinking at different times. Dr. Horowitz says she sometimes comes up with her best ideas when she's driving or has just woken up in the night or in the morning or is otherwise unavailable. So she recommends having sticky notes in the car or on the bedside table or on any of the places where you might get a great idea and want to jot a note despite not having a computer at hand. If you like dictating notes instead, be sure to have a dictation app on your phone or a recorder that you can carry and have close by. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Tonight, Monday, November 2nd, at 5:30, Bear Pond Books in Montpelier presents the next in their book club series with Mosaic Vermont, exploring the themes and artistry of Know My Name, a memoir by survivor Chanel Miller. More information at bearpondbooks.com. The Norshire Bookstore in Manchester Center presents a conversation with former Write the Book guest and recent Write the Book guest, Bobby Ann Mason, about her new book, Dear Ann. Norshire Live will have Bobby Ann Mason in conversation with Steve Yarborough Thursday, November 5th at 5. More information at norshire.com. You can also listen to my interview with Bobby Ann Mason on the podcast site. The Vermont Humanities Council will be presenting a number of digital presentations on Wednesday, November 4th at 7. And there are so many of them, I'm not going to announce them. They include Atlantic is a Sea of Bones, that has to do with a conversation about transatlantic slave trade. Another one about the complicated histories of monuments. Another about the American Civil War and the shaping of the Western Hemisphere. Many, many others. Those can all be read about on vermonthumanities.org. I've been closing out the show regularly with thoughts about the pandemic and encouraging you to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs and virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. Also, tomorrow is Election Day. Have you voted? If so, great. If not yet, find out how to get out there and vote. Make sure your vote is counted. Make sure that you are safe as you do it. Wear a mask, socially distance, and just be careful out there. But do try to vote. It's patriotic. It's so important. Our votes should all be counted. For all of you who are trying to write these days, do be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. Also, I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce for the Bookworm's calendar. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And if you like the show, please rate it on your favorite podcast site, like it on Facebook, tweet about it, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well, have a great week, and vote.